now from Acts 26. This is one of the most superb examples of oratory in all of literature. In this address before King Agrippa, in which Paul concluded at what must rank as one of the most inspiring verses ever penned, he concludes it with this verse, if you recall. I wish to God that not only you, but all of those also who are listening to me today might become such as I am, apart from these chains. And by our standards, life had been very cruel to Paul. In addition to a permanent physical handicap, he had, in his words, faced death again and again, served many prison sentences, been beaten with the regulation 39 stripes by the Jews 5 times, beaten with rods 3 times, stoned once, shipwrecked 3 times, and on the open sea for 24 hours. He lived in constant danger for his life. He knew exhaustion, pain, long vigils, hunger, thirst, living without meals, cold, and lack of clothing. During the end of his most difficult and challenging life, his convictions remained unshaken. They held as he faced the king who was his judge, a king who had the power of life and death over him. And in this noblest of scenes, when Paul, unshaken, says he wanted all to be such as he was, he wanted them to be such as he was, you see, his life convictions in Christ had become him. When one studies the life and the writings of Paul, it isn't difficult to realize why he has had a greater influence on more people in Europe and in the Western Hemisphere over the last 2,000 years than anyone who ever lived. Yes, it is a great and wonderful thing to have convictions that can stand the test of time and trial, to have convictions that become stronger with each passing year. And so impressed was I with these words of Paul that about 7 years ago, I began writing down my convictions. I commend this exercise to everyone here. Sit down and spend some time putting down what you really believe, and then add to them as the Spirit moves you, and as the Spirit has moved me to do, to add to these in the last 24 hours. I want to share some of these convictions now with you, and in doing so, I want to pay credit to my masters, my teachers, whose writings and whose fellowship have been such an inspiration to me. And that goes for, of course, many in this audience tonight, which I will not name, but you know, I'm sure, who you are, and some of you may not know who you are, who have been such a great inspiration to me. To those who are not here, I first mention Elder Ogness because he would so much have liked to be here, as he told me just a week ago that he had looked forward to so much to this. And then to Fritz Norstedt, who is ill and needs our prayers. And then to the late Dr. and Mrs. C.S. Lewis, Helmut Tillicke, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Paul Tournier, Dorothy Sayers, J.B. Phillips, Charles Williams, Søren Kierkegaard, Jacques Ellul, Father Nogar, Keith Miller, George MacDonald, and many others. And these names are authors, in most cases, of books that I recommend to you and that are on the shelves of the library here. I recommend that you might replace many of them as you go back to the planet Earth, that you spend more time with them than instead of being perched before the idiot box. Now, my first conviction is this: whatever one sows, that shall he also reap. There is a moral law that is built into the nature of the universe in which we live. It always has the last word. No one small or great individual or nation can ignore it. No matter how you dress it up or hide it, it will be revealed. There is nothing covered that shall not be revealed, or hid that shall not be known. H. Stanley Jones said, anyone who thinks he can cheat the moral universe is a moral imbecile. You'll have to pay, maybe not at the end of the day, week, or month, or even the year, but pay you will. This moral universe is not something fabricated out of special customs, traditions, or religions. It is built in, and it is subject neither to vetoes nor abrogations. It stands. And you don't break its laws. You break yourself on them. They are immovable, unimpeachable, and you can't run away from them because they are within us. We are caught in them in a web of past deeds, in a tragic dilemma with only one door of escape, and that through the door of grace. And it's an open door, and it is sad indeed that so few enter the door. If we do use the door, we are overcome. If we do not use the door, we are overcome by the consequences of our own doing. The moral law closes in, and there is no grave deep enough to bury the evil in this world. For whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap. Jeremiah had something to say on this subject, and typical of Jeremiah, he said it more harshly. He didn't mince words. Everyone shall die for his own sin. And about the only Christians who really recognize this are the converted alcoholics. They realize the significance of this statement. Most of the rest of us do not. Here Jeremiah was pointing out the importance of personal responsibility, a very unpopular subject today, for we are plagued by neutral values. For most of us in our generation are a bunch of ticket fixers. We accept the privilege, but we don't want to feel the responsibilities for our own actions. A popular t-shirt in the very recent past has written on it, "The devil made me do it." I believe the consequences of this philosophy was impressed on me in a way I shall never forget by an incident in a play by Arthur Miller entitled The Fall. And probably you've heard Al Rogness discuss it. One of the important characters in this play is a lawyer whose life is falling apart. And this lawyer says in one of the opening lines that he thought of life as a case at law. When young, he tried to prove how strong and how smart he was. Later, what a great lover, and then what a good father. And finally, when old, how wise he was. And then he went on to say, he expected to be judged, to be justified or condemned. At least he expected and he felt he deserved a verdict. He then stated one day he looked up and the bench was empty. There was no judge in sight. And without a judge, life became an endless conversation with himself, a pointless litigation of existence before an empty bench. And that is despair. Man and woman, if they are to have dignity and worth at all, must be given the honor of being judged. If he or she is neither bad nor good, neither justified nor condemned, he or she is no longer a man or a woman. If the bench is empty, we are of all beings most to be pitied. My second conviction naturally follows the dilemma caused by this moral law, and it is this. The Bible has the answers. Now, I know when some of you hear me say this, you are probably saying, boy, how simple can you get? We're back in Bible school. Platitudes, you say, you can do without. Sometimes theologians do more to cloud issues than clarify them. I think I can explain what I mean by what somebody wrote on a vacant wall in a Midwestern college. The words are these. And Jesus said unto them, "Who do you say that I am?" And they replied, "You are the eschatological manifestation of the ground of our being, the kerygma in which we find the ultimate meaning of our interpersonal relationship." And Jesus said, "What?" This prepares you for something Karl Barth, the famous theologian, under whom some of you have studied, and certainly some of you have learned a great deal. I know Carol has brought much of Barth to us with great effect as we studied him in one of our fall seminars. Now, Karl Barth visited this country one time, and when he arrived and course, I think the person questioning them was probably aware that he had written literally volumes and volumes. But as many correspondents do, they try to simplify things or confuse them, whatever the case may be. But in this case, the correspondent said to Karl Barth, "Could you sum up your theology in just a sentence or two?" He says, "I can do it in the words of a song my mother taught me. Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so." David in the Psalms states it this way, "Thy word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path." Some years ago on a visit home and before our folks moved away from the farm, I was looking over some material that had been put away and was all but forgotten. And among the dust-laden material were some old kerosene lamps and lanterns. And I must admit to some nostalgia and not a little sadness as I thought about what these lights revealed in earlier days. The birth of the children in our family and the animals, our evening prayers, the bedside of some of us when we were very ill, and more mundane things like the way to the barn, the chicken house, the milk house, and on festive occasions like when we sang and danced around the Christmas tree, singing Norwegian Christmas carols. Now these lights that had showed us so much now lay dusty and dark and discarded. Of course, they had been replaced by other lights, brighter ones and more beautiful ones. They had performed their function, and even for these lamps, night had come. The Bible is called a lamp and a light. It too may shed its rays or lie unused. But for this lamp, there are no replacements, no new and modern lights to take its place. If this lamp is abandoned, the long dark night sets in. There are many today who seek lamps, new ones in modern shops, but they find none that really work. And so they fall into temptation, grope in fear and anxiety, and circle in darkness and despair. But the light is here. I have just read from it. And we need only to reach for it, open its pages, and search prayerfully. And the light breaks forth. As Mary told me this evening when I visited her, you know, I get so confused by and the complexities of some theology and now the Holy Spirit. So I just decided to go back to the Old Testament, the New Testament, and read it again and see what it says about the Holy Spirit. The Bible will never be extinguished by the storms of the enemy. Its light will flicker and die because its friends, you and I, forget to use it. Don't be beguiled by the flickering phantoms that promise light, but give cause to neglect the true light and what true and beautiful light this book sheds. Where else can you find such words as, "He that keepeth me never slumbers nor sleeps"? For I consider the sufferings of the present time are not worthy to be compared to the glory that will be revealed. Or this most significant one, "Him who comes to me, I will in no wise cast out." These are the words of Jesus, or were inspired by him, and he died for them. That's how serious he was, and he deserves to be given a chance. My third conviction is, God is real and must be taken seriously. I was reminded of something when I came to this point in my sermon preparation, and it's from C.S. Lewis. I recall what he wrote. He really reminds us in some writings that reality is usually something you could not have guessed. And for this reason, he explored Christianity. For it was a religion you could not have guessed. If it had offered us a kind of universe we would have expected, we would feel that someone were making it up. But it isn't the sort of thing anyone would have made up. It has just that queer twist that real things have. Yes, the God of the Christian is real and must be taken seriously. Now, it is maybe surprising to many here to hear a scientist make such a statement. I am thankful there are many brilliant scientists who continue to believe that true learning is with reverence crowned, and science walks with humble feet to seek the God that faith has found. It was Pascal who observed, humanly speaking, things must be known to be loved. Divine things must be loved to be known. Persons too must be known to be loved. I believe the secret of this mysterious, unbounded, and wonderful universe in which we live cannot be contained in an equation, only in a person, uniquely one person. And faith depends on that person because he was, and in himself, the assurance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. I'll admit for a time I thought God in nature was the thing to seek. He was lovely and convenient, and he did nothing to me. He gave no commands, he made no judgments, and I would never have to die for him. And all I had to do was to enjoy him. But there seemed to be a hooker. He was above and beyond my everyday private life, really out of it. I prefer a bigger God and a more local one. So I chose one who was not only the creator of the universe, but a God who also became man, who became local in the lives of so many, who gave sight to the blind, healing to the sick, and wept by the grave of his friend, and gave comfort to the sorrowing, and tonight, here's your child as it prays. Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray thee, Lord, my soul to keep. Helmut Tillich, one of the best known theologians and preachers in Germany today, says there are two and only two ways to take a thing seriously. Either you renounce it or risk everything for it. We must either throw Christianity on the trash heap or else let God be Lord in our life. And if the latter, let him really be that. Someone from whom you receive each day meaning, comfort, a goal for life, and marching orders. Don't carry him around in your pocket or tie him up in your handkerchief. Either curse or fall on your knees. But you say, can't we have a third choice, something in between, a middle road? Half Christianity always leads to dejection. Depression has its roots in a divided heart. The divided heart just wants a little bit of God, and then always finds it to be an impediment, a break, or a pain. For you see, a divided heart ends up getting just enough to bother the conscience and deprive it of unconcern. The result is unhappiness. Only the single-hearted have real happiness. They alone learn God is the source of all power, the one who gives freedom and zest for life, and that following him is the most joyful thing in the world, because he frees man from all things that torment and tug at the half-hearted. So if we take God seriously, what then? What are our orders? I shall dwell on only one, but at some length, and it is what Kierkegaard called the royal law. You shall love. As we become serious followers of the Master, we embark on a kind of life that involves both joys and sorrows in a special kind of way. If we live for and within ourselves, we can shut out much of the world's anguish. The pain of others may not be our pains, their fears need not be our fears, their failures need not be our failures. But the moment we become disciples, we are plunged headlong into the pains, the fears, the failures of others. We begin carrying a cross we never had to bother about before. Everyone becomes my brother and my sister. To love and to serve God at all, I must love and serve my brother and sister also. And not only on Sundays and at church. If God means nothing to us in the area where we spend most of our everyday life, if he is not Redeemer there, then Sundays are of little account either. It is a comfort for me to know that in almost every case, people became involved with the Master while at work. Fishing, tax collecting, drawing water, during the routine business of everyday life. And if not this, at times of great distress. If God is to be taken seriously, we must love and have concern for our brother and sister 7 days a week. And it is only the person who has tried to love another person in Jesus Christ and allowed him to purify that love, who knows the flooding, uplifting power that comes with this transposition of the heart. It brings joy unspeakable. any person or any community, whether at Holden or elsewhere, transformed. It most knows more of the intellectual charity, vulnerability, peace, and joy. With it, one learns to live with few defenses and with one's deficiencies without being judgmental. These relationships make it possible for others to grow, prisoners released to free other men and women, for they live in the daily forgiveness of sins. And without this daily forgiveness of sins, there can be no communion and no community. There is a naturalness, a healing quality, and a wholesome sweetness about it that one would give anything to share, to see this love at work. To see it at work is to know that's how it ought to be. And I will close this discussion on this love by quoting from four people whose writings have meant a great deal to me. The first is the poet Auden. We must heed his words when he says, "We must learn to love or die." The second is Vannevar Bush, who is a very distinguished scientist. The process of evolution did not teach us to rejoice in the beauty of nature, nor did it produce the concepts of honor and integrity. The making of a poem or the benediction of music in an open field at dusk has little to do with crass survival, yet here they are. Love can reach far higher than the needs of propagation demand. It can produce new life, but it can also make life worth living. The third person is Loren Isley, who in his recent book, The Unexpected Universe, paints a haunting picture of a star thrower. And I know some of you are probably getting tired of me telling you this story, but it's a picture that I shall never forget, and I don't want you to forget it either. In this story, he tells about one day when he walked along the beach of Costabel, a beach that was littered with many forms of life, many dying forms. And it seemed to Isley the sea was rejecting its offspring. These life forms would fight their way out to the sea only to be cast again, rejected upon the shore. Among these were starfish that lay shrinking in the hot sun. And as he walked, Isley came upon a stranger leaning over one of these starfish. And he asked him, "Is it alive?" "Yes," said the stranger, and with a gentle but firm grip on the starfish, he spun it far out into the sea with these words, "It may live if the offshore pull is strong enough." So both of them went along the beach picking up rejected dying starfish and throwing them into the sea in the hopes that they would live again. Commenting on this event, Isley wrote, "Somewhere there is a hurler of stars." Now, I have told you this to remind you that we must become more avid hurlers of stars, giving others a chance at life. Now, the story doesn't end there, because the fourth person that I will quote tonight is Alice, and she is here. And this was part of a sermon that I prepared, really a thing on joy. It was done in response to many students here who came to me some time ago and says, "Leo, you must talk to us of joy." And so I prepared this thing on joy and gave it at a couple of the Holden banquets. And then I thought, well, I should send this to Alice. And I did, because she is a very wonderful correspondent. And she has a real deep insight into such matters. And I think that I could hardly understand that she could have read the whole sermon and written back 14 pages about it. I will not give you 14 pages of it tonight. I will only give you three. She had just summarized about four paradoxes. We surrender to win. We give away to keep. We suffer to get well, and we die to live. And then she says, Then your theme, hurler of stars. What I see there is the reason one hurls stars in the first place. It's like Schweitzer's reverence for life. You like life to live, but they all wound. Only those who reach where the offshore pull is strong enough. But we humans must give or hurl, and God determines where the offshore pull is. We must always remember that. We are never God, but God is there. We know that. We must hurl stars, and in God's time, they will reach the offshore pull. We who do the 12th step work, and that's in Alcoholics Anonymous, have to learn that. We can only hurl. Some miraculously get into the offshore pull, and we are glad. Others do not. But we don't despair. We keep searching for more stars so that all may be hurled within our sphere and reach God in his time, or their time, whichever. Stars often have to be picked up again and again. Sometimes you throw and wade after them and throw again. We do know the offshore pull is there because we were dying once, but we reached it, and we are grateful and humble in our new life of joy, painful as it sometimes is. But even in overcoming that, we experience more offshore pull. That is how I see it today. I may see even more tomorrow. I have I was deeply moved by this, and I'm sure you are too, to remind you and me again that we must be more avid hurlers of stars. Or as Jesus, when he came to the place of worship, and he could have opened up to a lot of chapters in the Old Testament, but he turned to the 61st chapter of Isaiah, where he read how he came to set the captives free. So I ask you, would you take time to bother with someone, or just to listen to someone, to help the lonely old lady down the street, or try to understand the mean kid next door, or to help the mother of the large family that lives near who never has a moment's peace with all the children, or the mother of the retarded child? Could you bother them by saying, I'll watch while you take a few hours away? Remove the mask from the one in need, and you find God, in that you have done it unto the least of these, my brethren. You have done it unto me. My fourth conviction has come to me only in the last 24 hours, and it is this. The way of the Spirit is mysterious indeed. The way we are guided to lend support to our brother and our sister are beyond really understanding and finding out. A poignant reminder of this came to me from the life of Paul Tournier, whose writings have meant so much to me and to so many of you. Paul Tournier was an orphan. He was orphaned by the death of his mother, or rather his father, at the age of a few months, and his mother at the age of six. He lived with some relatives then. And in his early life, he became very introverted with a very serious problem relative to social adjustment. He shut himself in deep moral solitude, in his words, and he didn't think he was of importance to anyone, although he was surrounded by love. But when one has these kind of feelings, he or she is insensitive to love. And during these early trying years, he had grown up some, but he was still very introverted when he entered college. And a most unexpected person came to him to help him. He was a distinguished Greek master in the college that Paul Tournier entered. And he recognized that Paul had a deep and serious problem, and he realized that he must learn to know him as a person. So he did a very unusual thing. He invited Paul to come to his house, which is not done, or was not done in that time. And he came to meet then this Greek headmaster, who was a very strange fellow. He had a very long beard. He had a great big cane with a silver head on it, and he also had a very large hat that he always wore. And he was passionately concerned with antiquity. And a very unlikely fellow. He was sort of a philosopher. And he invited then Paul into his library, which was stacked with books, and Paul was very disturbed and he was very ill at ease. But with time and with several meetings, this person became a great counsel and help to him. And one day Paul said to him that he was a Christian, and although he admitted that it was sort of on an academic level. And the Greek master, in response to a question from Paul, admitted that he was not a Christian, but that he believed in a higher being. He believed in a universal spirit. And then in reply to another question by Paul Tournier, he said that he did not pray, because one cannot pray to an impersonal God. It is only a personal God to whom one prays. Many years passed, and Paul advanced in his studies, and he chose to go into medicine, mainly to straighten out his own problems by his own admission. Although his gifts really directed him into mathematics, he eventually became involved in the healing ministry, where health and spiritual things meet. And as a result of this, he has become a very great help to literally millions of people. And one of them is me, as I have come to know him and have met him and discussed some problems with him. And because of his experiences in these years, he decided to write a book, fortunately, and since then has written many books. But after he had completed this first manuscript, he said, well, I must have someone read this. Now, he could have gone to a lot of people to have him read this, because he had made many friends in the interim. But something directed him. I believe the Spirit moved him, because the person that came to mind right away was the old Greek master, who by now was very old. And so he called him up, because he hadn't seen him for a long time. They had exchanged Christmas cards, but that's all. And so he called on him after the schoolmaster agreed that he would see him. So he went early one afternoon, not without some fear and trepidation. Rather than to have him read the manuscript, Paul read it to him. He finished the first chapter, and it was greeted by silence. This silence, which seemed almost interminable, almost an eternity to Paul, was only interrupted by Paul continuing. And so Paul read chapter 2. And he again was met with the same silence. After a period of time, he said, Paul, continue. And so he read the third chapter. And by this time, his heart became very tight. But yet he looked at the old man, he could discern nothing that would reveal what his thoughts were, but he was very worried that he did not like it. And he read the whole afternoon with this kind of thing going on, silence after each chapter, until he finished the whole book. And by now it was late afternoon. And then there was a long silence. And then the Greek master said, Paul, we must pray together. And Paul Tournier was very deeply moved. He said, but you said you never prayed because you believed in a universal spirit. Are you a Christian now? And he said, yes. Since when? Since now. And just a few days or a few weeks after this, the Greek master became ill. And Paul was there to minister to him until he died, and at his request preached the sermon. You see, Paul was the only star thrower between the Greek master and eternity. And he got him and brought him to where the offshore pull was strong enough, in a way that neither Paul Tournier or you or I or anyone can explain or could have predicted. And in retrospect, that Paul should be the one to do this is most appropriate. For the Greek master, who, although not a Christian star thrower, was the one who really brought Paul to where the offshore pull was strong enough. Yes, the Holy Spirit moves in inexplicable, unexplainable, mysterious ways. My final conviction is in an answer to a question posed by Job and many before and after him. And it is this: if a man die, shall he live again? My conviction in reply is the resurrection of Jesus Christ has made all the difference in the world. Job said it more beautifully: I know that my Redeemer liveth and will one day stand upon the earth. Christ arose from the dead, and things have never been the same since. After that, anything could happen, and it has. You may well ask, if Christ died and rose again, why can't I? And I say you can. At this time of the year, baseball fans get pretty excited because the World Series are upon us. And there is something that is always dramatic, ominous, and nerve-tingling if the series goes the whole route. There's something very exciting about that seventh game of the World Series, and it is this: there is no tomorrow. For each of us, such a day will come in our life, and for most of us, sooner than we think. Death will most surely come, and it becomes so awesome when we write off the resurrection of Christ from the dead. Then you have what we got: generations of people whose history can be summed up in miles of blacktop, 1,000 lost golf balls, and split pins still standing after the last ball has been rolled down the alley. On the road, on the golf course, at the bowling alley, we try to escape for some moments from reality, from what is stark reality that would certainly for every one of us, all of this one day is going to come to an end. One day it will all be over. It seems everybody plays the game, but nobody wins. Yes, death seems to stalk us at every turn, and we can't escape it. Oh, there are some who try to ignore it. The family of Gautama Buddha was such. As a youth, he lived in a very princely palace where he was protected from all signs of decay. Before he was allowed in the garden, maids were sent out to take away all dying flowers and all fallen leaves, so he would be protected from all signs of suffering and death. But then one day he went out unattended, and he saw a dead man. He was emotionally overcome, and he reacted with spiritual violence. And it changed his whole life and many millions of his followers into a vast pessimism. So what are we going to do about it at the end of this journey we call life? We have two choices. We can either say with King Saul, I have played the fool, or echo with Paul, I have fought the good fight, I have finished my course, I have kept the faith. And it all hinges on how we regard the first Easter morning. I guess almost everyone believes something happened at Easter time some 1900 years ago. Millions, however, cannot quite believe it's true that Christ was raised from the dead. Other millions are quite sure that it is not true. They say things like that just don't happen. Cynical realism holds many people today. Cynicism appeals to people who are certain that everything is purely ordinary in this world of ours, and nothing extraordinary, nothing that feeble finite mind cannot explain, can ever happen. Oh, they'll admit a remarkable man named Jesus of Nazareth resided on an earth a long time ago for a brief period and was then crucified. Almost everyone has to admit that. But a miraculous birth or resurrection? No. After all, they say other religions too have their incarnate and suffering gods. The Egyptian Osiris died and rose again, they say. And there was the suffering Zeus and Eumenides who reconciled man to God. But in these theologies, their suffering, their God suffered and died in some remote and mythical prehistoric time. The Christian story, however, starts out with names, places, dates, hours, and most significantly, witnesses. Yes, the witnesses, you see, the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead was a verifiable fact of vivid memory in the minds of many people who saw him after his death. To them, a new age was born, a new faith came into being, and a new spirit entered the world. Life gained a new beginning, a new middle, and a new end. And this belief, this experience, caused a profound change in them. The difference between the men who forsook Christ and fled from the Garden of Gethsemane, and those who a few weeks later were neither silenced or intimidated by prison, torture, or death, was astounding. Yet they were the same men, but something most assuredly had changed them. And they were so certain for the reason for this change that they chose death to deny it, and their experience has been perpetuated until today. And the experience is so well illustrated by a page out of the life of Felicitas, a slave from Carthage, who not only endured martyrdom, but in a sentence defined the faith. Before she was thrown to the beasts, she lay in prison, and there she gave birth to a child. In the pain of childbirth, she screamed. And on hearing her screams, the jailers asked her how, if the pain of childbirth made her shriek, how did she expect to face her death when thrown to the lions? Her answer defined the faith, and we must hear it and imprint it upon our lips and our hearts. Now I suffer what I suffer. Then another will be in me who will suffer for me as I shall suffer for him. I'll give it to you again. Now I suffer what I suffer, she says in childbirth. But then, as she is thrown to the lion, another will be in me who will suffer for me as I shall suffer for him. In those words, Felicitas taught us how to meet our death. Now, what about the death of one near and dear to us? That must be the severest test of all. As some of us here tonight, as some of you here tonight can tell us, most lucidly in tear-choked voices, as they tell you how their 12-year-old daughter died, she who was Holden personified, who lived a life of love and joy and thoughtfulness that Jesus taught us, a life that brought joy to so many. Yes, it's a real test for us as Christians when death visits our family. The one who is taken, the one who is gone, seems to invade the mind the more. Perhaps it is because in this strange company we are at one with those who are gone. But the ache and emptiness is there, for we are so fiercely tied to the touch of a hand, a gleam in the eye, and a sound of a voice. And when the test comes to us, will we pass? I think Betty and Howard have passed this test, for they recognize the presence of the Comforter. The Holy Spirit is called the Comforter, and as Carol has pointed out, it means come forth. It's strength. It gives us strength. And they told me today how help and strength had come in the mysterious and many mysterious ways to them. And that's what happens in a real Christian community. For when one tastes salt, all taste salt. As we prayed for Betty and Howard, I guess many throughout this country prayed for them, and there were more than one pillow that was wet with tears for them. I believe also that Al Rognes passed the test. I first met Al, I guess, about 15 years ago. And he told me of his son Paul, then an Oxford scholar, who was soon to come home for a big homecoming. But he never quite made it, for another homecoming intervened. Al Rognes explains it in one of the most beautiful eulogies ever written, and it is with this I will close. He was only 24. He had been center on the football team, steersman on the crew, childhood, high school, Christian College, Oxford. The years had mounted upward in a spiraling crescendo. In George MacDonald's words, he was a gleam-faced, pure-eyed, strong-willed, high-hearted boy. And the rising plateaus were before him. Suddenly, his youth, his life was ended. The roar of a motor, a broken body on a city street. Youth is not a preparation for life. Youth is life itself. There is no time for rehearsal. The great play is on. Every day is another little block of time in which to live. To live, to love, to serve, to weep, to laugh. You cannot employ today only to set the stage for tomorrow. Or there may be to no tomorrow. Long years ago, a youth of 33 writhed to his death on a cross. And across the centuries, this young man summons other young men and women to join him and to give him the vibrant, aspiring years of their youth. These years may be the only ones that can be given.